That's South Africa's Winston Mankuku Ngozi with Dedication. He was 24 years old at the time that he composed that. It's from his 1968 album, Yakali Nkomo, supposedly in protest of apartheid and bringing to mind, he said, recreating the atmosphere at the time, Yakali Nkomo referencing the bellow of a bull as it is taken to slaughter. Winston Mankuku Ngozi died on October the 13th, 2009, at the age of 66, but through him, you see the continuum of music, Charlie Parker being a major influence. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. In an emotional, teary-eyed speech yesterday at the White House, President Barack Obama delivered yet another homily about gun violence, imploring an impassive Congress to enact measures to curb illegal gun sales. He's not waiting to act, he says, in this little clip we're about to hear, noting a list of mass killings he linked to easy access to assault weapons. According to the White House, the president is taking several executive actions that will be enacted to address these long overdue regulations and policies, and he's going it alone. Let's take a closer look, shall we? First, let's hear that teary presentation by President Obama yesterday.
Unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from high schoolers at Columbine and from first graders in Newtown. First graders. And from every family who never imagined that their loved one would be taken from our lives by a bullet from a gun. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day. So, all of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies. All of us need to stand up and protect its citizens. All of us need to demand governors and legislators and businesses do their part to make our communities safer. We need the wide majority of responsible gun owners who grieve with us every time this happens and feel like your views are not being properly represented to join with us to demand something better.
Well, I tell you, I listened to it, and I have no doubt that the president felt very emotional and compassionate, even as he spoke. But he is a political person, after all, and this is the political season. And he is a Democrat, and he is a Democrat who's leaving the White House very shortly and is looking toward building a legacy. No question. The issue of what is euphemistically called gun violence is an issue, but it depends on how you look at it. Let's take a different look at this issue of gun violence. It is good, and we cannot berate the president's concern about the alarming rate at which American citizens are dispatching each other, whether in or out of uniform, and for all kinds of reasons. But the gun itself has a very interesting place in American history. It is inseparable from American history. In fact, I would even argue that American history began with a gun, with guns, with gun violence, at least what we know as American history. And it began with gun violence not just here, but in the lands of people who came here, met people already living here, and were bent on exterminating them here and subjugating people elsewhere with guns. It's quite significant, it might have been a slip of the tongue, but it's quite significant that last on the president's list of tragedies, mass killings, it was introduced with the phrase, and by the way, it happens every day on the streets of Chicago, he said. By the way, Chicago is his city, the city from which he comes, and the city from which the presumed standard bearer in this presidential race, Hillary Rodham Clinton, comes, and the city from which the Clintons' right-hand man, Rahm Emanuel, comes and is the current mayor in a city that is roiling over the issue of gun violence, and particularly a unique kind of gun violence, the violence of police killing citizens of Chicago. But the president meets history and then ignores it and simplifies it, gives us a one-dimensional view of this thing called gun violence. What is that? What does that phrase mean? A revisionist at heart, although he swears he is a student of history, gun violence means limiting access to guns. He's not opposed to guns. He has made that quite clear. He's not opposed to people having guns. He dare not make such a statement because it will irritate a sizable portion of the United States electorate. And this being an election year and other non-election years being very important to expanding the Democratic Party, you don't say anything that is likely to rattle outright the NRA. So, being a constitutionalist, he favors gun ownership and the exercise of the Second Amendment. He's a Second Amendment guy. Right to bear arms and so forth. And by the way, right there, we have another kind of history about the right to bear arms. Now, I suggest that the president, since he and his various departments have the resources to do this, on that matter alone, why not undertake a study and see, with this issue of the right to bear arms, how many people of color legally have been able to apply for a gun permit and been given it, as opposed to other people who apply for guns? I mean, it's an interesting thing. How many law-abiding people of color are able to obtain gun licenses? I mean, it's worthy of some kind of inquiry. Maybe the Justice Department might look at that. You know, the same Justice Department that wants to just tweak the administrative codes that the police use to obliterate citizens. We're not changing things. We're just tweaking them. He's a tweaker. But to get back to the point, the issue of gun violence is, in fact, an extremely important and inseparable part of American history. Today, we are encouraged to believe that this is simply a matter of, well, gee, the more guns we have in the hands of reckless people, and you know, these are code words. And reckless people, people who are smart, like the ones down there in Oregon, occupying federal land with guns, are seen as responsible citizens. The president hasn't named them as an example of the kinds of craziness that could occur when rational people have guns. They are openly defying the government. They are daring the government to come and force them off federal land and force them out of occupying, that is to say, taking over federal buildings and threatening to make good on their belief that the government dare not exceed its authority over the people, that the people have equal authority with the government. And what allows them to make that claim and to affirm that right is what? Guns. So we have to understand that the gun is a symbol of a number of things, not just the mass murder of people. And then he presents that history as just being recent development. These are just recent things that have happened. I submit to you, gun violence was what started this country. It is the culture of this country. It is absolutely linked to this whole idea and notion of white supremacy. Guns were made to obliterate your enemy and to obliterate threats to your power. That's the way it has always been. That's why it was, the gun was created. It wasn't created for any other reason than for killing. So I went to the White House website today just to see how the White House interpreted, you know, for purposes of public relations and so forth, how the White House itself interpreted the news conference that the president gave yesterday. And what did I find? Very fascinating. That while the media had been primed and everyone reported that the president is taking executive action, that is, he is issuing rules and regulations that don't require or will not require or in defiance of the impassible Congress, the non-cooperating Congress, he's taking action, executive action, to override any possible objection or impediment that they may pose. And really, when you go down the list of the things that the president wants to enact by so-called executive order, none of these things rises to the level of executive action. They're all, you know, in the language of Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney General, they're just tweaks. Now, I was prepared, certainly, for the president to take executive action, that those things that he was going to ram through would be absolutely important. And essentially, what he's suggesting is, you know, we should, and this is from the White House's own communique. Number one, they're saying these common sense executive actions. So it means that you have to take executive actions to enact common sense things. I mean, we've reached this level. We have no common sense except that which is given by executive action. And number one on the list, according to the White House, I'm reading, you know, because this is really important. I mean, the president called a news conference and he's crying and he's talking about how important it is and all these people who were killed and the children and so forth. Number one, says the White House communique, keep guns out of the wrong hands through background checks. Well, haven't we heard this before? And is this really so explosively important? I don't think so. That's the number one priority? To keep guns out of the wrong hands. Well, that's understandable. The president is talking about this. Everybody talks about this. Wrong people should. But who are the wrong people? And who are the right ones? Who are the right people? Make communities safer from gun violence. I'm reading what they're saying. That's number two on the list of priorities. Make our communities safer from gun violence. Do you understand how, you know, anachronistic that sentence is? Safer from gun violence. All right? But that's what is number two on the list of executive actions here. Increase mental health treatment and reporting to the background check system. That's number three. These are devastatingly important measures that require executive action. I'm not making this up. Number four, shape the future of gun safety technology. How about that? These are really incredibly important things, according to the president. And if all these things happen, we will have no such thing as gun violence. All we have to do, according to the logic here, is throw a couple of hundreds of millions of dollars at it. And that would solve the problem, essentially. Now, if ever there was an embarrassing moment for the intellectual capacity of the White House, this is it. The president sees it necessary, and he forces the issue at a news conference, and he cries, and he announces executive actions, which are quite common sense, and to my mind, require no executive actions whatsoever. But he has taken what he himself describes, and the White House, I should say, describes as common sense approaches to executive level. And what we end up with is essentially the president is proposing some bureaucratic changes, of course, which will entail several hundreds of millions of dollars. So then you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of this news conference? And it's so clear. The purpose of the news conference is simply to take advantage of the political climate, to claim his ground, and to build on what he sees as his legacy. And it was an opportune moment to divert attention from the person who is dominating the news right now, who's Donald Trump, and the Republican gains in terms of politics, and to provide a kind of launching pad for Hillary Clinton's ensuing claims about gun violence. That's what that was about. And the whole thing is orchestrated so that we will have this appreciation that the president is taking resolute action. Now, here's what I would have thought would have come out of an executive order type news conference. Well, let's talk about the export of guns and the manufacturing of guns. The president isn't touching that. The president has never proposed a limit to the manufacturing of guns, only to curb their availability to the wrong people. You see how that works? Now, if you really want to be courageous, you say, look, we have reached the limit of reason with regard to the manufacture of guns. So I am proposing by executive order that we have a limit to the number of guns manufactured in this country. Now, that would occasion to me a presidential news conference announcing an executive order. Not the bureaucratic things that you want departmental reports done. I would have thought that the president, by executive order, would have required, insisted on a report, not only on the number of guns manufactured, but a halt to the exportation of guns from the United States, especially in other countries where they're wreaking havoc. He's only concerned that U.S. citizens are being mowed down by other U.S. citizens. But are we concerned about the millions of guns that are ending up in places like Libya, for example? Maybe he needed to ask Hillary Clinton about that. How many guns, Hillary, were in that compound that you describe as a diplomatic building? How many guns went to Syria to arm the rebels? How many guns has the United States exported to the wrong people in other countries? How many guns have accounted for the deaths of millions of innocent children abroad and here, but also abroad? See, the president isn't talking about that kind of gun manufacturing and that kind of threat posed by illegal guns. And the fact that the gun industry is doing remarkably well. It's a robust industry. The government is not objecting to the sale and the manufacture of guns at all. So you can't really go with the tears. There's a tearjerker. This tearjerker news conference yesterday should trigger a discussion about, a real discussion about guns. Guns in American history, guns in world history, guns in white supremacy, guns and oppression and repression. These are the kinds of discussions that we ought to be having about guns. Guns and race, guns and genocide. You see, these are the discussions we ought to be having. The relationship between guns and all of these horrible things. Now, he is not likely to call the news conference to discuss that. But he would like us to know that he is mindful of the negative impact that guns and illegal guns obtained illegally, without even mentioning what's going on with guns obtained quite legally. He's got an issue right there, as I said, right now in Oregon. All of them have legal guns, and all of them are defying the government. That is, in real time, an armed resistance. That is a huge threat If it were any other group, it would be considered an act of domestic terrorism. But, you see, guns, depending on who has them, it's either a threat or it's a constitutional right. So I think while the president was so emotional about guns and the illegal ownership of guns, we ought to be having a real discussion about guns and the place of guns in American history and in American society. Guns are very American, and guns have a very special place in our historical memory, associated with genocide, mass murder. You think we've seen mass murder? You ask Native Americans about that. Guns and race, guns and genocide, guns and the control of society, guns as an expression, a continuing expression of white supremacy, guns and the statement by the state itself, guns and the rise of the Klan, guns and the relationship of guns to domestic terrorist groups that have for centuries been subjugating all other groups with guns. So I thank the president for providing us the opportunity to raise this question and to now begin a real discussion about the importance of limiting guns and the role of the United States in propagating the exact opposite. As many guns as you want in repressive nations, we will supply. I'll take this little break and come back and talk about God just don't like ugly. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And as we speak, an interesting development in Chicago, the suburbs, the bucolic suburbs of Chicago. In one part of Chicago, people are being obliterated. Just yesterday, we had more gun slayings in Chicago. But in the bucolic suburbs of Chicago is a college, Wheaton College, that was founded all the way back in, I believe, 1860. But in 2013, that would make it just 2 years ago, this college found itself a bit generous and saw the need and saw that it was time to appoint its first female African-American tenured professor, Dr. Larisha Hawkins. And as we speak, she is about to make her exit, not by her own volition, but by the college's decision. Dr. Larisha Hawkins, in the aftermath of the mass killings in San Bernardino, California, and we saw the rise of anti-Islamic sentiment in this country generally. Dr. Larisha Hawkins, a very devout woman, she's a Christian, decided to express solidarity with Muslims. And she began wearing a hijab, which is the traditional covering for Muslim women. It's a covering to indicate modesty. And she, on her Facebook page, entered apparently an explanation of that, or made reference to that, by saying that she was explaining her identification with the discrimination and the out-and-out racism being directed at Muslims. And it was her small effort to indicate some kind of solidarity with them. A symbolic thing, but she didn't mean any more than that, and explained that in her eyes, Muslims and Christians are basically worshiping the same God. In its broadest sense, it simply means we're all one. There's no major, she sees no difference. Well, the folks at Wheaton, which is an evangelical school, said that, hey, no, we don't approve of that at all. That is inconsistent with our doctrinal conviction. And they asked her to account for herself. How dare she say a thing like that? Because, according to them, Islam and Christianity are like, oil and water. They don't mix. So they demanded an explanation of her interpretation of this premise, and she seeking clarification. And she says, I don't have anything to explain. And so they are meeting, or they might have decided by now, who knows, that she will be making her exit. As a tenured professor, they have to observe the law and go through the stages of dismissal. So that's what they're doing. But it is clear that they intend to dismiss Professor Hawkins. So my question to you is this right? The university or the college is saying that when Dr. Hawkins was hired, she signed an agreement, which was the agreement on defining her terms of employment, that she was going to abide by, and she identified with the beliefs of the college. And the college has a belief system of some sort or another. I don't know quite what it is, but it is taking the position that her expression of solidarity, not just the expression, but her theological philosophy, which they're saying was what the expression was, that Muslims and Christians alike are worshiping the same God. And this, in the eyes of the university, is tantamount to blasphemy. It's so against their brand. So they're going to make her pay for it by dismissal. What are your views? 888-874-4888. Now, what do you see here in this development? And it's going to get a little larger than it is now, I can assure you, because some people will say, well, we're arguing basically on the constitutional question of freedom of expression, freedom of speech. She expressed an opinion, and should she be penalized for that opinion? Others are saying, look, you agreed to certain terms and conditions of employment. You signed this employment agreement with the college, and you are found to have been in violation of that. Which is the right way to see the situation? What are your views? I'd be very much interested to know. 888-874-4888. Have we reached a point in the United States where a person has to be very careful of what you say publicly, if it in fact might infringe or be seen as infringing or contradicting your employment, which is a private matter? That's a very serious issue. But particularly because we have this dynamic of Christianity versus Islam, is there a special indication here that the college is reacting on that basis, not really on the academic question or the theological question of Christianity and Islam being alike more than dissimilar? What is, in your view, the best way to resolve this situation? What do you see as the motivation here? All right, we'll take the first call as soon as it gets in. 888-874-4888. Now, while I wait for... Oh, I see somebody calling in. While I wait for that call, I just want to thank those of you who have started the Lead Stories study groups across the country. I see that many people are doing this and beginning to help promote the station, helping to promote the program, and I really do appreciate that. It is a great comfort, and it helps us build our community. And this is very, very pleasing to me, and it says a lot about how we are going to move this year. We are going to expand our realm of influence, our sphere of influence, and we're going to engage with each other, talking and exchanging ideas. And that's how we do it. It's a simple thing, but it is a meaningful way to do it. Okay, so, well, I don't see calls yet, but I will start the conversation here. I think this is important for us to take a look at because there's a deeper issue, too, about who is entitled to an opinion and who is not. Well, we have Chris from New York. Perhaps he will tell us. Hello, Chris. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to get to the point as quick as possible. And before I say this, let me say I don't mean to get rid of Christian people or religious people or Muslims. I don't mean to get rid of them, but I do think that religion itself is part of this problem. And
okay, that said, what do you think of the specific situation?
Well, in this specific situation, I see it the same way I see what will happen to you if you're an NFL player and you say something negative about the NFL. If you work for an oil company and you go on TV and say global warming is real. It's not necessarily the religion, it's the powerful and the powerless who presume that they have some freedom or some power, but really they don't. And you get reminded in situations like this when you try to exercise some delusion of freedom.
And how do you think this ought to be resolved?
Resolved?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like to fantasize, like some positive outcome? Is that what you mean?
Just what do you think should happen here?
Oh, what I think should happen? I don't think we should have any schools based on, I don't think we should, first of all, I don't think we should have a school with a religious, designation or title. I don't think she should be punished in any way for showing her allegiance to an oppressed people. But again, these religions oppress people.
All right. Well, thank you. You got the conversation started. Thank you so much, Chris, for your call today. From Dallas, it's Sarah. Hello, Sarah.
Well, great to see you, Teresa. Can I be heard clearly?
Yes, if you talk a little louder, it would be better.
Okay. Is this any better?
Yes.
Okay. Well, greetings to you, Detrice, and greetings to the PRN audience. It's been a while since you last spoke.
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. And I went through your discussion today on this college professor. I'm going to say something that might not be in total agreement with some of the members. And I feel that what she did with her personal expression of solidarity with the Muslims and them being targeted by this government, that is a personal issue that she should have kept to herself and not make it a part of her college orientation, since she know what she was doing. You see, I get very offended when I find people using their religion in public spaces and making it something that we should all agree with. And I think it's something that is very distasteful, especially in the United States, with this hypocrisy when it comes to religion, and everybody wants to wear it on their sleeve only at their convenient time. And this woman being a professor, and as you said, if it's some evangelical college, and we should already know what their leanings would be, it would more than likely be Republican right-wing leaning, and with the situation with the Islamic so-called terrorism, it was going to be very opposed views. And that is something that we need to learn to keep certain things, we need to keep it out of our workspace. And I find it, especially with a lot of us, with black people in particular, because I notice it on the job that I'm on, and I notice that we tend to bring certain things into our working space that needs to be kept private.
And what this does her constitutional right to freedom of expression or free speech come into play here as being, like a trump card with respect to her expression of a view on her Facebook page? And is she protected there on constitutional grounds?
Well, if she posted, but what you need to look at also in a lot of our contracts, they say what you do personally that could reflect negatively within your workspace, they can also hold that against you. So, for instance, you might think that, okay, I'm off the clock, and I'm doing my own personal thing, but if you get picked up for a DUI, your employer could fire you for that, because it would negatively reflect back on the company that you work with. And so that's why I keep telling people that there are certain views and opinions that you might have, and then something, because social media is going to be the detriment for a lot of people losing their jobs, because they're using it in a very inappropriate manner and posting a lot of personal information on their pages that they really and truly don't need to be posting. If you want to be in solidarity with the Muslim sisters and wear a hijab, then you take it upon yourself and you just come to work like that. You come to work in that manner. You don't have to announce it to the world.
Well, you have some really strong points here. Thanks so much, Sarah, for your call, and good to hear from you, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Yatrice.
Thanks. From New York, Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. What are your thoughts about this?
Okay. Do you remember Professor Salaya? I think that's his last name. And he was a professor who had given up his tenure in one university and then got a job in another university. And he himself is an American citizen but he is from, I believe he's from Palestine. And he tweeted, or he put on his Facebook, supported I forgot exactly what it was in Palestine. He was supporting and gave, some kind of opinion about Palestine. And then what happened, I think it was the University of Chicago, that then after he was hired, they fired him. He was never able to go to university. I could be wrong on the university, but I think it was the University of Chicago. He sued, and I heard, I think it was last month, he's not getting that job back, but he's getting money from that university. What I'm trying to say about this and what this woman did, if she used her Facebook page, I believe that has to be a personal matter and her personal opinion. And that's what Zelaya did too. It was on his Facebook page, I believe. Another thing is, I'm non-Christian, I'm a Muslim, and I get hired by let's see, a Catholic university, and then I go out somewhere, and maybe I had an abortion, let's just say, and they disagree with that. And that comes somehow on my record that I did that. I wanted to know, what are my repercussions for something like that? And this has to be protected. I know what Sarah said, that you have to keep your personal view inside. Then I will never go out protesting and put my life out there for people to see what I believe in. I think we have to be protected from freedom of speech, freedom of religion. She just expressed. She never said, I'm not a Christian. She said, it's just one God. And if there is one God, it's the same God for everyone, not just for one religion.
Okay. Sound points that you raised today, Ali. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kwame, you will be bringing it home. Kwame from New York.
Yes, how you doing, Patrice?
Fine, thank you. Now, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think she, you know, according to what she had done on social media, she went against the foundations of the belief system of that white supremacy, evangelistic Christianity at the university that she works at. Remember, these type of universities, they spend millions of dollars on converting Muslims to become Christians. They'll go to an area in a Muslim country, and they'll send a person away for 15 years. And out of those, maybe that area has 350,000 people who live in that village. And if they can convert 1 to 3 people, that's a success to them.
So, in your view, does she have any standing with respect to her constitutional rights, or does the university prevail?
I mean, she should, but we know how that goes. She has no, I mean, basically, when certain things that you do, you have no rights. Basically.
Yeah. You have no rights. She has no rights?
No, she has no rights. That's the standard verity what the university is saying. Like, the heck with her rights. She went against the foundations of our principles, our beliefs. So, like, we're going to can her.
I see what you're saying. Thank you, Kwame, for your views today.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program. I thank you for your views. Very, very interesting, as always. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. And tell everybody you know about the station and about your favorite program, Lead Stories. NDC Savings Club is up next, and you want to stay tuned for that. Again, it's a great pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. You can reach me always and let me know how these programs are resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com. Thanks again for tuning in. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.